evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. UNICEF is appealing for millions of dollars to support South Sudanese.
The nutrition sector is the sector that requires the most funding in 2019, little over $50 million. That speaks to the insecurity around food for the population of South Sudan, which hopefully, as we all really hope, that the peace agreement takes hold.
And UN landmine experts say mines still pose risks in South Sudan.
The most contaminated areas of the South Sudan are in Equatoria, generally, because the theater of the war was in Equatoria. There are no new landmines, despite the fact that we have been fighting for the last 5 years.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, is making an appeal for nearly $180 million to meet the humanitarian needs of thousands of children and women in South Sudan. An official with UNICEF in South Sudan says although the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in September 2018 paves way for a better life for women and children, more than 4.4 million children need assistance. Onen Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
Andrea Sule, the acting UNICEF representative in South Sudan, says most of the money will be used to provide food aid because the country is still food insecure.
The nutrition sector is the sector that requires the most funding in 2019, little over $50 million. That speaks to the insecurity around food for the population of South Sudan, which hopefully, as we all really hope, that the peace agreement takes hold and the population is able to go back out and farm and have access to food. It does speak to the fact that the needs for children with regards to nutrition is still acute.
Shule says she doesn't anticipate the situation will improve drastically anytime soon. She says UNICEF is also appealing for $45 million will be used to fund the water, sanitation and hygiene sector in 2019.
In South Sudan, only 50% of the population has access to safe drinking water. This is a number that it puts children, women and all of the population at risk with regards to disease and health in general. We're looking for $44 million for education. South Sudan has the largest number of out-of-school children in the world.
Sule says despite the peace deal, many South Sudanese are still suffering.
2019 provides a lot of opportunities. The revitalized peace agreement has been signed, and this sets the ground for a better life for women and children in South Sudan and for the entire population. However, the humanitarian situation still remains dire.
Shule says right now in the dry season, the main constraint is insecurity.
And that's why the Equatoria still remains a challenge for us. Baguiri has been an entrenched challenge for access for quite some time. However, there has been lots of positive signs in the past month about accessing humanitarian aid going into Baguiri. It's also important for us to access the pastoralist children, which are not so impacted by insecurity necessarily all the time, but they themselves are mobile.
Shule says those children need access to education. UNICEF's appeal comes 1 month after the children's agency said that the world is failing to protect children living in conflict zones around the world with catastrophic consequences. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
The United Nations Mine Action Service says there are still many undetected landmines and unexploded devices across South Sudan. A program manager with the UN agency says up to 39 square kilometers of land in South Sudan still needs to be cleared of landmines and unexploded ordnances. The UN agency today destroyed two large bombs outside Juba town. Winnie Chirino was there and has this report for VOA from Juba.
Quiet! Firing!
That's the sound of a 50-kilogram bomb being demolished by ANMAS while buried inside a 1.5-meter hole in Jebel Blinyang Bare village outside Juba today. It was the demolition of the 1 millionth explosive item in South Sudan. Jirkoch Baraj, head of the National Mine Action Authority in South Sudan, says many unexploded ordnances remain across the country. He says the worst area is the southern part of the country. Baraj says he hopes the remaining contaminated areas will be demined so that the land is safe for farming and development.
The most contaminated areas of the South Sudan are in central, are in Equatoria generally, because the theater of the war was in Equatoria. There are no new landmines, despite the fact that we have been fighting for the last 5 years. But we have the contamination in terms of what we call yoxos, or unexploded ordnance.
Richard Balter, program manager of the United Nations Mine Action Service in South Sudan, says the unexploded ordnances and landmines originated from Sudan and were planted in South Sudan during the war for independence. He says the two unexploded ordnances demolished today were found by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the National Police Service 2 weeks ago next to Juba International Airport.
Over the course of the last 14 years, together we have assessed and cleared 1 billion square meters, 1.25 billion square meters, which is 1,250 square kilometers. The number that matters right now is that which remains. And our estimate at the moment is approximately 39 square kilometers, comprised of 210 minefields, 124 cluster strikes, and 35 battle areas.
Balter says he hopes the unexploded ordnances will be cleared over the next 5 years. He says UNMAS has documented the number of the victims of explosions, but more people could have been killed who didn't make it to the hospital.
9 people have been hurt this month alone. 1 person killed and 8 injured. This problem won't go away on its own. Overall, the number now is 5,035 people killed or injured, 1,383 people killed, and 3,652 people injured. But the number will grow.
Balter says many unsuspecting children have died from landmines and exploded devices. He says they often play with the objects or take them home, which puts more lives at a risk. He wants the public to be extremely cautious.
If anything looks like a bomb, if they suspect it, unless they absolutely know something is safe, don't touch it. And if anybody sees something that they consider suspect, they need to call our hotline, which is 092-000-1055. And we'll send a team out and assess it. And if it's an item of dangerous ordnance, we will destroy it. They can have their metal back afterwards if they want, but it's better that we destroy the item safely than they risk their lives and those of everybody around them.
UNMAS says it is working to create a safe and secure environment for the people of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
A new book explores the rise and the fall of South Sudan. Its author, Zach Vertin, a foreign policy analyst who lived in South Sudan and previously worked with the Brookings Institute, the Wilson Center, and the International Crisis Group, talks about the importance of self-determination which led to South Sudan's independence.
What was unseen to many outside South Sudan, and I think what is being better understood in the years since, is that in the wake of John Garang's tragic death in 2005, a really vicious battle for control of the SPLM and thus for South Sudan began. And that was very corrosive, both for the party and for development in South Sudan at a time when all hands were needed on deck. And I think what unraveled in 2013 and what we're seeing even happen today can in some ways be drawn back to those three things. And I do think it's incumbent upon all of us, both external partners but also South Sudanese, to try and understand those things and the roots of the current crisis.
So what would be your advice to policymakers at the South Sudan desk, anywhere in Washington?
Well, I think, and the book does delve in quite a bit to the relationship between the historical relationship between the Washington and South Sudan. And I think that relationship, first and foremost, delivered huge dividends in terms of providing food and humanitarian aid at during the liberation struggle, ultimately helping to end the war and later to safeguard independence. But And so, you know, the role of the West is a sub-theme that runs throughout this book. First and foremost, I think the fate of South Sudan belongs to the South Sudanese, so one can't simply look to foreigners for the answers. But having adopted the underdog's cause in South Sudan and leaned on the scales, and then I argue moved on too soon, I do think the role of the West and Washington in particular warrants critical reflection. And I do try to do some of that in this book. And so I would advise the desk officers in Washington to first try to unpack that history and try to understand where a sometimes simplified narrative and a sometimes uncritical embrace of South Sudan's elite may have helped contribute to the current situation. So that would be first and foremost before any further action would be to try and understand that. And then secondly, I think in addition to trying to fix the current situation and trying to do what external partners can to support efforts to make peace in South Sudan now, I do think we don't think about this with an appropriate time horizon. Too often, outsiders don't think about this in 5 and 10 and 15-year terms, and I think that's a more appropriate horizon. And so I think an important part, as I mentioned, of an important ingredient in South Sudan's long-term success is going to be generational change. And I think it was important to start investing in and partnering with the 30-somethings and the 40-somethings and the 20-somethings. And you surely know there are lots of really capable, really interesting, really dynamic young people, both inside South Sudan and those who have grown up elsewhere, that are really the reason that I have hope and optimism in the future of South Sudan, and we all should be doing as best we can to support them.
That was Zach Vertin, author of a new book, A Rope from the Sky. He was speaking to Ayen Dengbior last week. Tomorrow, Vertin talks about the impact of recent policy decisions on South Sudan and offers his advice on policy decisions towards that country. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the Ebola outbreak kills 2 soldiers in DRC. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the best advice you have ever gotten?
I got an advice from my mom. She encouraged me to work hard. That she told me, and a very successful woman is a very hardworking woman.
The great one I can remember is the one my father gave to me to study hard. Actually, he was on his, I can say, maybe a deathbed. He was so ill. He had a stroke and he was so helpless. He couldn't do anything for me. That was the last day I even saw him. It was like, my son, study hard.
Is from my father. He has always told me that I shouldn't be afraid to learn new things and to take up new challenges, because he said that you're only afraid to take up new challenges when you haven't tried it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. At least 15 mass graves have been found in northwestern Democratic Republic of Congo in the wake of 3 days of fighting in December, a spokeswoman for the UN's MONUSCO mission in Congo said on Tuesday. Earlier in January, the United Nations estimated that at least 890 people were killed as a result of violence, some of the worst in the area for years, which highlighted the precarious state of inter-ethnic relations in Central Africa's peaceful regions. MONUSCO's special mission, looking into the circumstance of the fighting, found at least 11 mass graves and 43 individual graves around the town of Yumbe, and at least 4 communal graves containing at least 70 bodies in nearby Bungende. Spokeswoman Florence Marshall said, "A dispute linked to a tribal chief's burial is seen as a catalyst for fighting between the Banunu and Butendi communities. It led to governmental council voting in the area for last month's presidential election. While bloodshed was not directly related to the December 30th vote, a local activist told Reuters that at the time, tensions between the two ethnic groups had escalated because Butende leaders were supporting the ruling coalition while Banunu leaders backed opposition candidates. Meanwhile, the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has killed two soldiers as the death toll continues to climb. An army spokesman said three other soldiers are under observation. In South Sudan, vaccinations against the deadly viral disease began on Monday. Healthcare workers and others who deal with the public are being vaccinated because of fears the DRC's outbreak could jump the weak border. Rwanda earlier vaccinated its health workers near the DRC border. The World Health Organization says neighboring countries have not reported any cases, but warns preparedness is crucial. South Sudan received 260 doses of the Ebola vaccine that has proven effective. Since the outbreak was declared on August 1st, 733 confirmed and probable cases have been reported, with 459 deaths in DRC. It has been difficult to bring the disease under control because the area is an active conflict zone. South Africa's coal mining heartlands has the worst air quality in the world, according to a recent study by environmental group Greenpeace. The 12 large coal mines in this area make it the world's hotspot for toxic nitrogen dioxide emissions. Residents and health experts say the effects are ruining their health and their lives. VOA's Anita Paul went to the coal heartland of Middelburg, South Africa, for this report.
35-year-old Patrick Mdluli considered himself healthy until he moved 2 years ago to Mpumalanga province, South Africa's coal mining heartland. He developed breathing problems, including tuberculosis and nasal issues.
The mines, the dust, pollution. You go to doctors, they tell you the very same thing. Are you living next to a mine? Yes, I am. Are you living next to a dumping site? Yes, I am.
A large coal mine operates, literally, in Mdluli's backyard. The mine has conducted blasts every day, shaking his small home to its foundation and causing a large crack in the wall. This sunny swath of South Africa last year earned the unfortunate distinction of having the world's worst air quality, says the environmental group Greenpeace. And it shows, says the head of one of Middelburg's main clinics, Dr. Mohamed Tayob. Tayob has lived in the area his entire life and says the emissions from the mines have made many of his patients sick.
Children and adults are paying the ultimate price. When we say ultimate price, is the neurocognitive loss of neurocognitive development. Children's infant mortality rate is higher in our area than other areas. Adults' heart attacks and respiratory disease are much higher. So people are paying with their lives across the board because of these pollutants in the air.
Tayo blames the coal mining industry and poor governance. Although mines are big money, locals say the coal companies have done little to improve the community. Middelburg is poor and many people lack basic services like electricity and running water. Tayob says the government is also failing to enforce environmental laws and crack down on the mines.
One cannot be faulted in thinking, is there some level of corruption operating in this area as well, where these big boys are getting away with murder, literally. They're literally getting away with murder. It's just a reality. I mean, I'd like somebody to come up and dispute this fact and challenge me on that.
VOA contacted three of the larger mines in the area for comment. None of them responded to our request. Environmental activist Bafana Hwatshwayo says he and other activists are preparing to lobby decision makers at an upcoming mining industry gathering in Cape Town. They want the coal industry to shift to a cleaner resource, the region's abundant sunshine. Bringing solar panel production to the area, says Hlatshwayo, would also create jobs.
We're not saying we want to close down the mines. We must go the renewable energy way. So when we talk about the energy renewable way, we are saying people will manufacture solar panels inside South Africa, and they are the ones who are supposed to install the solar panels, and they are the ones who are supposed to maintain the solar panels.
But that is a faraway dream for people like Mdluli and his neighbors, who complain unemployment is high and all of them, including the children, have health problems. This province, says longtime resident and environmental activist William Giane, used to be beautiful.
It's an endless akoni now, Mpumalanga. It's not a threatened part anymore. It's an endless akoni.
South Africa is the continent's largest coal producer and relies on coal to power much of the economy. But for the poor communities that live in the shadow of coal mines, it just makes them sick. Anita Powell, VOA News, Middelburg, South Africa.
From South Africa, we move to Nigeria. As Nigerians prepare to head to the polls next month, the Independent National Electoral Commission says the percentage of women in government has fallen to a low of 7% in the last 3 years. Only about 6% of 460 lawmakers in Nigeria are female, and the most prominent woman in the presidential election has withdrawn her candidacy. Timothy Obieza has this report for VOA from Abuja.
Nigerian technocrat Obieza Kwesili was aiming to change Nigeria's political landscape by running to become the country's first female president. But she pulled out of the race just 3 weeks before the February 16 vote to support a coalition against the main parties. The move shocked supporters like Raymond Chinedu, who saw her as a symbol of new hope for gender equality.
In Nigeria, it is difficult to support a woman to that level. So that's where the disappointment comes in. But we believe if the men have failed all this while, it is our mindset that at least having a woman in the system, running the system, we believe that things will have taken a different shape.
Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says women occupy only 6% of political offices. Director Oluwole Osaze blames cultural and religious factors for the shortage of women in politics.
I wonder if it has a higher percentage. Part of it is probably because of affirmative action, because in their laws, in their constitutions, they have things like that. We don't have that.
Ezekwesili co-founded the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in 2014 and openly marched against the government after Boko Haram terrorists abducted hundreds of schoolgirls. The former education minister is also a co-creator of the anti-corruption agency Transparency International. It's a notable record in a country known for widespread corruption.
Politics undermines everything that we do in this country, whether it is what citizens do, what businesses do, the society at large does. It undermines governance.
Nigeria's Election Commission said it was too late for Ezekwesili to withdraw from the presidential race and is likely to publish her name on the ballot. This could split some of the opposition vote, and it's unlikely Ezekwesili will even remain the top female candidate for president. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
The UN Refugee Agency says there was an alarming increase in the number of refugees and migrants who lost their lives last year while crossing the Mediterranean Sea. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Last year, the UN Refugee Agency says six people died on average every day while trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. It estimates 2,275 people died or disappeared crossing the Mediterranean in 2018, despite a big drop in the number of refugees and migrants arriving in Europe. Last year, 139,300 people arrived, the lowest number in 5 years. In 2017, on routes from Libya to Europe, the UNHCR found one person died for every 38 people who went to sea. That number rose sharply last year to one death for every 14 who arrived in Europe. UNHCR spokeswoman Liz Throssell tells VOA, "The spike in refugee and migrant deaths is largely due to major cuts in search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean."
That really has resulted in the Mediterranean being the world's deadliest sea crossing. Non-governmental organizations have been carrying out sea rescues, but during the course of 2018, their ability to operate has been curtailed. So what we're seeing is that there's a lack of search and rescue, people setting off desperately, and the result is people are drowning at sea.
Throssell says preventing search and rescue operations will not deter people who are fleeing persecution or extreme poverty from risking their lives on the perilous sea journey. The UNHCR is calling for a strong regional and collaborative approach to protect refugees and help save lives at sea. It says that European countries bordering the Mediterranean Sea, countries such as Italy, Spain, and Greece, should not be solely responsible for caring for the refugees and migrants that come ashore. The agency says this is a burden that should be shared among all European countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. UNICEF is making an appeal for nearly $180 million U.S. dollars to meet the humanitarian needs of more than 800,000 children and women in South Sudan this year alone. A top UNICEF official in South Sudan says although the signing of the September Revitalized Peace Agreement lays the groundwork for a better life for women and children, nearly 4.5 million children still need assistance. Andrea Suli, the acting UNICEF representative in South Sudan, says most of the money will be used to provide food aid because the country is still food insecure. She says the need for children regarding food is what she calls acute. Suli says she doesn't anticipate the situation will improve drastically this year. UNICEF is also appealing for $45 million to be used for water, sanitation, and hygiene in 2019. The United Nations Mine Action Service in South Sudan says far too many landmines and unexploded devices still exist in the country. A program manager at UNMAS says up to 39 square kilometers of land in the country must be cleared of landmines and unexploded ordnances. UNMAS destroyed two large bombs about 15 kilometers outside of Juba today. It was the 1 millionth explosive item demolished in South Sudan. Jerkuch Barach, head of the National Mine Action Authority in South Sudan, says the worst area is the southern part of the country. And finally, a UNESCO spokesperson says at least 15 mass graves were found in the northwestern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo following 3 days of ethnic fighting last December. Earlier this month, the UN estimated that at least 890 people were killed as a result of ethnic-related violence, some of the worst the country has seen in years. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Fi Sabab by Ras Corby.
لكل حاجة اللي بحصل في الدنيا فكنت بالك وما تستاجي معكم اوريجينال راس كوردي في السبب
لازم يكون في سبب يا
في السبب
لازم يكون في سبب
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب يا
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب
في سبب
برا بنا كلك الدنيا
في سبب
برا جيبي زوج ومرا
في سبب
بالومان برابا يا
في سبب
بشمج وقم ربي تلا لازم
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب يا
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب يا
في سبب
لازم يكون في سبب في سبب بجنون بينك قالوا في سبب
We have been listening to Ras Corby with the song Fi Sabab. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. We'd like to know what you think about this show. Our email is voa@southsudan.com. If you are traveling out of Juba where there is no VOA FM, you can still listen to us on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kHz, 13865 kHz, and 15180 kHz. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.